Let's find a conversation to your soul. Let's conversation to your soul and the
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are very excited to welcome back to the podcast today to discuss his new book, Greg Grandin. You already know, but Greg is the Peter V. and C. Van Woodward Professor of History at Yale University, and we're talking about his new book, America, America, A New History of the New World. Greg, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back.
So we left off last time at kind of the eve of the Civil War. And I know the Civil War isn't a major focus of the book, but how does Latin America and U.S. relations transform over the second half of the 19th century, of course, culminating in the war that has a million names, the Spanish-American War, the War of 1898, the Spanish-American-Cuban War, the Spanish-American-Cuban-Filipino War of 1898. And why is that such a key moment? So I and then we're going to really focus on the 20th century, but I think we should sort of close out the 19th.
Yeah, well, I think it's a turning point in the sense it's a transition from, as you know, Matthew Karp writes about how the Democratic Party and the slavers were in the command of foreign policy and imperialist policy in the Americas, you know, so it was very much in the minds of many Latin American diplomats and politicians, you know, the aggression and interventionism and annexationism that the United States had pursued throughout the first half of the 19th century. Probably the Civil War was very much associated with the South, with slavers, with expansionists, with settlers. And there was a sense that the Republican Party was different, and they certainly applauded Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you know, the book does go into the way Lincoln imagined Central America and Haiti as a place to export free people of color to solve the race question. But in terms of Latin Americans, they felt that Lincoln was a sincere man, as Jose Martí called it, and there was this incredible moment of goodwill. I mean, Latin America had abolished slavery without a civil war. I mean, I think that's the big thing, that emancipation didn't happen immediately with Spanish American independence, but there was the presumption that independence would bring about emancipation to the point where, depending on the local politics, some countries like Chile abolished slavery immediately, others much later, but they saw the United States' Civil War as a continuation of this, of the revolutionary promise, and they saw Lincoln, on as an equal with Simon Bolivar, and so the Civil War was a turning point. But then, of course, the Republican Party, when they're in the cockpit, become the agents of expansion and imperialism, right? They continue the policy of the conquest of the West, and in many ways, the Civil War. Winning the Civil War was predicated on that expansion, and it didn't take long for Latin Americans to notice and to readjust their opinion of back to the United States as an agent of expansion and a threat to be contained.
And so that, I think, obviously is really important. There's this turn in the late 19th, early 20th century, and I think that this has become a problem for American historians because this is the moment when the United States acts the most like a typical great power of Europe, with the seizure of various protectorates and territories, and unincorporated, I think, is the legal definition that this the Congress eventually develops, with basically the seizure of formal colonies. And though we still have those colonies over the course of the 20th century, American imperialism would function quite differently. So could we talk a little bit about the Spanish-American War and how you understand this American move to the seizure of colonies, and particularly how it related to what was going on in Latin America right before the Mexican Revolution, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah, well, yes, in some ways that was the terminus of all of this expansion, right? The continuation of the war, the frontier across the Pacific and down into the Caribbean. And there is a kind of transformation in the rhetoric in which the United States justifies its imperialism. I approached the War of 1898 by focusing on Jose Martí and Jose Martí's involvement in the Pan-American movement, which, you know, the first Pan-American conference is held in 1890. And Martí is constantly worried. You know, he wants independence for Cuba, but he wants the United States to support independence and to recognize the legitimacy of the insurgents in Cuba that had been fighting effectively since 1868, you know, with ebbs and flows in terms of the intensity of the war. But he wanted the United States to recognize the insurgency, but he also knew the danger of that recognition could also bring about the potential of annexation. Cuba is this weird island that's kind of, early in the 19th century was described the equivalent of it was constantly always about to fall into the hands either Great Britain or Mexico or Colombia or the United States. And the United States' intervention was in the War of 1898. The way I talk about it in the book is the Republicans who led that, they didn't understand it as necessarily imperialism. They understood it in much more idealist terms. They understood it as a kind of expansion of the rule of law. Again, they really trotted out a lot of the tropes of the black legend, the expulsion of Spanish brutality. I think the first time the phrase human rights was used to justify an intervention was in Cuba, where Spain was carrying out a very brutal and violent campaign of counterinsurgent pacification. So the War of 1898, at least from the point of view of Latin Americans, is understood as a kind of culmination of what they understood as an expansionist United States. But within the United States, they saw it as a moment of a consolidation of an international legal regime. At the same time that the United States is expanding and taking these informal colonies, it's also tentatively building out the beginnings of an international order that is supposedly defined by the rule of law. The Second Hague Conference takes place in 1907, where it puts into place a lot of the things that we'll see with the late League of Nations. Presidents like Theodore Roosevelt, Latin America itself is putting forward doctrines, the Drago Doctrine, the Calvo Doctrine, which are supposed to limit the ability of European nations or the United States to use gunboats in order to enforce debt collection. And, the United States is caught between and betwixt this. They don't mind citing those doctrines in order to keep Europe out of the Caribbean, but they don't necessarily want to be held down by those doctrines themselves. And so there's a going back and forth, right? That whether the United States is going to submit and support this new legal regime. And I think the United States very quickly realizes that it can support this legal regime, and it doesn't necessarily lead to a diminution of U.S. power, but more rationalization of power. And I think you see that certainly in the Roosevelt administration, Teddy Roosevelt and his Secretary of State Root. They support this, even as they're sending in gunboats to put down, to settle crises in the Dominican Republic. I mean, that contradiction really comes to the fore after 1898, where the United States has to figure out whether it's just going to be a policeman for U.S.'s private interests, or it's going to act as a kind of gyroscope to kind of stabilize a broader environment in which capital investment could take place. And the United States goes back and forth between the two, right? It's torn between, and you see it in the individual. You see, this runs through up to Wilson, where Wilson imagines a world rule of law at the same time he's sending in the Marines into Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So, it's an interesting moment, and it's an important moment in the evolution of U.S. power.
So, Greg, maybe we should move now to the Mexican Revolution. And talk about this in the book as sort of the shock that it presented to American capitalists with all the money that was invested in Mexico and all the all that was at risk from this revolution and the decision to, you know, how that affected the U.S. response. So talk a bit about the Mexican Revolution and the U.S. Reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean, the Mexican Revolution, you can't really talk about the Mexican Revolution outside of its real broader context. I mean, Mexico really is the axis on which so much of U.S. history turns. Even to this day, when you're trying to make sense of Trumpism, you go back and you look at the Texas secession and you look at the Mexico. We talked about this in the last episode, but I want to stress that it was real kind of nativist nationalism, a kind of Anglo-Saxonism defined against Spanish American nations, particularly Mexico, becomes a driving force of U.S. nationalism, of a certain kind of U.S. nationalism. You have all of these people who want to take all of Mexico. They want to take all of Central America. They want to turn all of the Americas, or if not all the Americas, at least the northern continent, into a homeland for Anglo-Saxons. It's very clear in the rhetoric. So, and there's a through line. And then Mexico becomes, after the Civil War, basically the United States' first nation-building project, liberal nation, in which capital from New York and the East Coast, from Boston and Philadelphia, flow into Mexico and basically remake a peasant economy into an agro-industrial, maybe not industrial, but agro-exporting nation in which all of its resource extractionism, its mining, its ranching, its wheat fields, sugar plantations, all held by U.S. capital, but also all of the infrastructure of a developing nation, the electrical companies, the trolley companies, the railroads. Mexico is basically a subsidiary of U.S. capital. And obviously it's ruled at the time by Porfirio Diaz, one of these classic Latin American liberals, in which liberalism has become basically
modernizers.
Yeah, right? Modernizers.
That's with modern modernizing.
Stability, yeah. Stability, order, and pacification, and consolidating central control. The United States goes back and forth in Latin America, and this is another way in which Latin America becomes a kind of workshop between supporting federalists or decentralizers when they don't like, when they have somebody that opposes U.S. interests in power, but when they have somebody in power that supports U.S. capitalist expansion, the United States is totally fine with the centralization of power. And Porfirio Diaz, of course, creates a very modern repressive state in which the railroads and the police and the federales and all of that is put to basically protecting property rights. And so the Mexican Revolution in 1910 is not to take anything away from the Haitian Revolution, which of course is an agrarian revolution, a revolution against sugar plantation, political economy. But the Mexican Revolution is the first third world revolution against industrial capitalism and its enabling myths. It starts in 1910 and it ends, anybody's guess when it ends, when it consolidates, maybe
17 or 20, right? Those are the 2 years usually. Yeah, 1917 or 21.
Great, the Cardenas Revolution, Cardenas' creation,
right? Later on, yeah.
Work for the pre and creating consolidating state, but also enacting the land reform. So the Mexican Revolution kind of, I don't know if we have time to get into the weeds with this, but Woodrow Wilson gets all caught up in the Mexican Revolution. And one of the, I'll just say briefly without going into the details, that you really can't understand the League of Nations and Wilson's actions in the League of Nations without understanding Mexico and Wilson's, the way Wilson threw himself into the Mexican Revolution in ways that were not necessarily bad. One of the things I was surprised about, because I grew up thinking, Wilson will teach him Latin Americans to elect good men. Mexican Revolution was an ideological challenge for Wilson. It really forced him to confront some of his premises. And for a short window of time, he imagined himself as ideologically sympathetic and allied with Pancho Villa with the, you know, he thought he was the sword of the Mexican Revolution. I think he used the word. He liked Villa for a while. But that's probably too much detail to go into. What really happens in 1917 is the elaboration of the world's first social democratic constitution. You know, it predates Weimar, it predates, you know, the constitutions in India and elsewhere that elaborated social rights. You know, the constitution, it had all of the kind of negative rights that we associate with the U.S. Constitution, or rights which restrain the state. But then it had a full palette of what we think of social, economic, or active rights, you know, positive rights, in which this requires the state to take action to ensure a dignified life. And, you know, I see this as the kind of fulfillment of a lot of the ideological currents that had been at play from the conquest forward. And in many ways, the drafter of its most radical provision, Article 27, the Constitution was passed in 1917, ratified in 1917, acknowledged the legitimacy of private property, but said that it was the state's prerogative, that the right came from the state, and that the state owned all subsoil resources. Now, what I've been saying this for quite a long time, but what was so radical about that? It's one thing to challenge liberal property rights and the presumptions that undergird them from a radical Bolshevik perspective, which you could just dismiss out of hand. You know, it's another thing when you're undermining liberalism from within, as the Mexican Revolution is doing by taking the presumptions of liberalism and extending them into the economic realm. And that's basically what the Mexican Revolution, and the person who drafted that was a country lawyer. He was in the Bajío region, the region that John Totino talks about as the epicenter of a certain kind of capitalism. And he saw the dispossession, he saw the massive land loss. And he and the committee that drafted Article 27 understood what they were doing as going backwards in order to go forwards, that they were rejecting modern notions of property and going back to more colonial forms of the idea of entailments and corporate rights. And built into Article 27, not just the right of the state to expropriate land and redistribute to peasants, which becomes, you know, an element of everything from the radical left to modernization theorists by the time you get to the 1960s, and incorporated into Article 27 the right to reconstitute peasant commons. You know, they're called ejidos. This article drove the United States and, you know, different agents of the United States business interests, particularly the oil industry, but also associated property holders, you know, lawyers. It was the equivalent of, you know, of basically Mamdani just winning the New York primary. They thought it was, they just didn't know how to deal with it. And they demanded that the article be struck from the Constitution. And of course it wasn't. It wasn't enacted so much. I mean, presidents gradually eased into it, but in terms of, for the first time ever, regulating say the petroleum industry, or forcing petroleum companies to register their properties, to pay taxes, to pay tariffs. But by the time you get to the 1930s with the election of Lázaro Cárdenas, he's the first person to fully apply Article 27, and he expropriates a massive amount of land. And just to give one quick example of one of the things that he did, and in comparison with the United States, he basically allowed the reconstitution of the Yaqui Native Americans were, if you think about them as the Cherokee, they were dispossessed, they were enslaved, they were removed, you know, their homelands were destroyed. You know, by the end of the 1930s, they had an enormous amount of land restored to them. It would have been the equivalent of giving back half of Tennessee to the Cherokees. That's what the Mexican Revolution did.
I want to come back to something we talked about last time, the Monroe Doctrine, because there is this debate over what the Monroe Doctrine means at the end of The Mexican Revolution at the end of World War One, as the discussions are happening about the League of Nations, you write about this. Wilson is sort of really, he's a little bit all over the place about the Monroe Doctrine, but he views it as this kind of basis for some of the things that he wants to implement in terms of the League of Nations versus Teddy Roosevelt, who's still hanging around at this point, who wants to turn Mexico into the Balkans of the United States and just police it. And that's to him what the Monroe Doctrine means.
Yeah.
And so there's this debate back and forth. And one of the arguments I thought was morbidly funny, I guess, was the Illinois senator, I can't remember his name, who said, arguing against the League of Nations. And his argument was like, what if we have to go to war with Mexico? What are we going to do? Like, do we have to go to the League of Nations? Why can't we just do it ourselves? And so, Lawrence Sherman, that was his name. Talk about how the Monroe Doctrine kind of plays into the larger themes here and the debate that's going
on. Yeah, it is. It's impossible to define, but if you remember, the Monroe, at its most fundamental level, is two different ways of thinking of Monroe Doctrine. It's either a doctrine of anti-colonialism, you know, Europe keep out, no part of the Americas that is independent could be reconquered. Latin Americans liked that part. They saw it as an analog to their own revision of international law, which I talked about earlier, that basically set the stage for the League of Nations and the United Nations and a revocation of the doctrine of conquest, an acceptance of borders, an end of aggressive war, all of that. Or it's a standing police warrant for the United States to basically go out and do whatever it needs to do whenever it wants to do it. There's two different ways of thinking about the Monroe Doctrine. And Wilson, this goes back to what I just glanced at earlier. Wilson, at first, you know, he dedicated his first two cabinet meetings just talking about Latin America, not even the Mexican crisis, just Latin America in general and how the United States has been aggressive and, has been humbled. If we understand what we've done in Latin America, we understand why they don't like us. And he really had he basically lays the groundwork for a certain kind of Pan-Americanism, and he embraces in many ways the Latin American version of the Monroe Doctrine as a doctrine of law, as a doctrine of sovereign equality, as an anti-colonial doctrine. So he starts to go back to the League of Nations. When he starts talking about the League of Nations in its earlier idealistic form, before it becomes the reactionary thing that actually was put into place, he's citing the Monroe Doctrine, you know, as Latin Americans cite it. If you want to know what we wanted, he would say, if you want to know what we wanted in the League of Nations, look at the spirit of Pan-Americanism. Look at the Monroe Doctrine. Now, of course, as, you know, Wilson's vision idealism crumbles under its own hypocrisy and, you know, the restraints he was operating under whatever, as the League of Nations gradually evolves into the mandatory justification for ongoing colonialism, nationalists in the United States want to know, well, what about the Monroe Doctrine? What do you mean it's the Monroe Doctrine? What do you mean the League of Nations is the globalization of the Monroe Doctrine? We like the Monroe Doctrine just like it is, just for us, for our hemisphere, granting us mandatory power in Latin America. So Wilson has to cave into that. So in the last final days of writing the covenant, he basically says, look, we need another article in the charter. In the covenant, we needed an article affirming the legitimacy of the Monroe Doctrine. And by that time, it wasn't the Monroe Doctrine, the anti-colonial Monroe Doctrine. It was the Monroe Doctrine that basically gave the United States authority to go in Latin America whenever it wanted. It was an appeasement. It was an attempt to appease, you know, the nationalists back home. Now, Britain was fine with that. They were like, yeah, that sounds good. You could have your Monroe Doctrine. Maybe we'll have a Monroe Doctrine for Africa. The Japanese said, sure, that sounds good to us. You know, China was horrified. Like, what does this mean? Because they knew, because Japan would later go on and say, you know what, we have a Monroe Doctrine for Asia. It's hilarious that, you know, you say it's those funny parts of the debate. When you read the debate where the other delegates in the drafting committee that Wilson chaired, they kept on asking him to define it. Can you define the Monroe Doctrine? Can you define the Monroe Doctrine? And he couldn't. because, you know, in his heart, to give him the benefit of the doubt, the Monroe Doctrine is this doctrine of proceduralism and anti-colonialism and law and equality. But he knew he was what he was saying, what the Monroe Doctrine that he was insisting that the League of Nations explicitly affirm the legitimacy of was not that Monroe Doctrine. It was the Monroe Doctrine of Teddy Roosevelt and all of the other nationalists. And so you had the French delegate. Can we at least have a footnote explaining what the Monroe Doctrine is? And like, of course, there's no footnote. So the League of Nations article, I think it's maybe Article 17, I don't remember exactly, basically affirms nothing in this covenant, you know, kind of, you know, something like the languages, nothing in this covenant, you know, denies the legitimacy of the Monroe Doctrine. But even having accomplished that, the U.S. still didn't ratify the League of Nations and join the League of Nations.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. We've all done it before, turning to our barista, hairdresser, or even a random stranger for life advice. As fun as they are to talk with about everyday topics, when you're looking for help about relationships, anxiety, depression, or other clinical issues, they may not have all the right answers. Instead, get guidance from a credentialed therapist online with BetterHelp. With over 30,000 clinically trained therapists, BetterHelp has a 4.9 rating out of 1.7 million client session reviews. You can join a session at the click of a button. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Find the one with BetterHelp. Listeners get 10% off with their first month at betterhelp.com/thenation. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/thenation.
So Wilson and also the Republican administrations of Harding and Coolidge also remain quite active in Latin America with various invasions and occupations over the course of the teens and the 20s, something that Americans just basically learn nothing about, that the United States occupied all of these territories. So I'm just... Before we get to FDR and his quote-unquote good neighbor policy, maybe you could set up that policy and explain what was going on in the teens and the 20s, and how do you think this relates to this social democratic impulse? Because ultimately, like you gestured toward earlier, the Mexican Constitution, super progressive, and besides a sort of Cardenas interlude of 1934 to 1940, it basically leads to the creation of a one-party state that lasts until the year 2000. So there's these other things going on, and one might argue that reaction wound up eventually triumphing. So let's talk about those occupations. Let's talk about the outcome of the Mexican Revolution into the pre, and then maybe let's talk about FDR's good neighbor policy.
Yeah, well, the occupation started under Wilson. So Wilson, you know, as he's wrestling with the reality of Mexico and understanding the need for revolution and imagining himself allying with the revolutionaries, you know, that's not Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So he's the, you know, so when this, you know, when this crisis caused by, you know, U.S. finance corporations or loans or, you know, or other investments in Haiti, Dominican Republic causes political turmoil, Wilson sent troops in and led to, you know, many year occupations of the Dominican Republic, of Haiti, and then later of Nicaragua, of course, with Sandino of, you know, fighting, Sandino launching his insurgency against Marine occupation in 1927. And those are all the occupations that basically are inherited by FDR when he's elected in 1932. It's the equivalent of, you know, I like, you know, when I teach, I say it's the, you know, Central America and the Caribbean were kind of like the equivalent of the Middle East. The more the U.S. projected military hard power, the more it needed military and hard power to pacify the crises caused by military and hard power, you know. It was a period. It wasn't a period of isolation. I know in diplomatic history, there's a tendency, despite all of the hard work that William Happen Williams did in the 1950s and 60s to insist that there was never a period of isolationism in the United States. I know in the common sense of diplomatic, some strands of diplomatic history, there's this idea that the United States was isolationist before Roosevelt, but that was not the case in terms of Latin America. The United States was all over Latin America. I mean, Wilson passed the Federal Reserve Act, and that was that act allowed banks like what becomes Citibank to basically ease out London finance and London capital and take over Latin America's banking sector, you know, that internationalized U.S. finance, the Federal Reserve Act, and that was passed under Wilson. So that's not isolationism. To answer your question about Mexico, I mean, a lot of this depends, to talk about, this is what makes Mexico such a fascinating place. When did it become reactionary? When was the revolution over? You know, was it the creation of a one-party state, or did the one-party state take all of the crises and sectarianism that would lead periodically, more than periodically, every other day it seemed, the assassination of a president, and incorporated into a party that was able to kind of work to broker all of those different tendencies and interests and constituencies, and it created one of the most stable, largest middle classes in the third world for a long time, right? It doesn't start to enter into decline until 68, 69, 70. That's when, corresponding with the neoliberal term and all of that. But, the Mexican Revolution is just shot through with paradoxes and contradictions that are debatable. How long the radical phase and continues, at what point its promise is betrayed is a perennial.
Yeah, everyone agrees by the 70s, the promise is betrayed.
The Revolution Betrayed is a great book by Adolfo Gili, and Adolfo was a trot. I mean, he's a wonderful scholar, a wonderful historian, but he had a very clear understanding of what a revolution was, and certainly the creation of an authority. You could see it in the historiography, right? Because in the historiography of the Mexican Revolution, there was this moment in the 1930s and 40s where U.S. historians like Frank Tannenbaum, they talked about they talked about the Mexican Revolution as this great democratic, eruption. Then, by the time you get, and even John Womack's Zapata and, 1968, Zapata and the Mexican Revolution, there's still a lot of that in that book. But by the time you get to the 1970s and 1980s, you have, John Womack himself thinking that the revolution did nothing but create a Leviathan state and really was just a civil war. And John Womack has this line in a famous revisionist essay, it was a civil war between different factions of the bourgeoisie, and the peasants paid the price. So you went from this kind of Frank Tannenbaum, the revolution as this populist eruption, to the revolution did nothing but create a Leviathan state. And then the next phase of that is historians going into the weeds with social history and looking at how nationalism resonated among peasants, among non-elite actors, and how, kind of Gramscian history of political culture and state formation. That was the kind of exit out of impasse between, is it a populist revolution or did it do nothing but create a behemoth, an oppressive bureaucratic state? You had this turn to kind of Gramscian political culture. And I think that's what still, huh?
For sure. And then people try to explain why did the pre like give up its rule peacefully and all those things. But that's a different episode. Let's return to FDR. And how did U.S. Latin Americans proceed over the 30s and then into World War too. And this good neighbor policy transforms, of course, the moment when the United States really steps on this global stage as the hegemon. How does Latin American play into that process? And how does Latin American sort of social democratic impulses react to the U.S. becoming the superpower?
Yeah, so there's a big push from Latin America throughout the 19th century for what they call American international law. You know, they understood themselves, you know, there was, you know, any given country was perennially in crisis, but they did develop a foreign policy cadre, across the hemisphere, Pan-American foreign policy cadre that understood themselves. They basically felt like the best way to stabilize domestic politics was to reform the international system. And so you had people like Luis Drago in Argentina and Carlos Calvo and all of these people that promoted what was intentionally called American international law, and they've tried to force the United States to submit to that. And the United States kept on saying there can't be an American international law, there can only be international law. International law is universal. And Latin America said, okay, we'll drop the adjective, we'll just call it international law. But at the foundation was a recognition of sovereignty. Right. That was the foundational premise. An end to aggressive war, an end to colonialism, an end to imperialism, and an end, in the case of the United States, the word that was used most often, an end to interventionism, and certainly an end to annexationism. And the United States, you know, refused. And all of these Pan-American meetings that they would have starting in the 1890s, 1, 2, 3, 4, onward up to Havana in 1928, you know, pretty much rehearsed the same arguments. You know, will you commit to being to giving up the right of intervention? And, you know, I'd say so, just stand there silently, and, you know, and nothing would really would. But at the same time, the kind of technocrats were building the infrastructure of Pan-Americanism. They were standardizing postal codes and telegraph, you know, whatever, you know, standards and weights and measures. So there was a kind of Pan-Americanism of the materiality of it as it supported the expansion of a hemisphere of capitalism taking place, even as the United States rejected the more political demands of Latin America. So then the Depression happens, FDR is elected. FDR has his two failed international conferences in Europe. You know, he wants to be a world leader, but the world isn't really responding. You know, Europe's going fascist, Asia's going militarist. And so Latin America on the docket is a Pan-American conference scheduled in Montevideo in October 1933. And he tells Cordell Hull, his Secretary of State, why don't you go down there rather than the Assistant Secretary of State and deal with the Latin Americans? And Hull at first didn't want to go because the U.S. was at that moment in negotiations to recognize the Soviet Union, and Hull wanted to be a part of that. But he went. He thought Hull was an odd duck at the beginning of the New Deal. He was from Tennessee. He understood himself as a Jacksonian. His father was a Confederate soldier who, you know, after the war, spent decades searching down somebody who blinded him to the exact revenge. But Cordell was more of a kind of reforming Jacksonian. He was open to the world, and he was a free trader. And he happened to have with him on that delegation going down to Montevideo, Ernest Gruning, who was an editor of The Nation. He was a radical anti-communist. He was Jewish. He came from a big, large, wealthy Jewish family. He had four radical sisters that were involved in all the kind of bohemian left and fighting racism and class struggling. And Gruning became famous for his opposition to U.S. occupation of Haiti. He compared it. He said it was the functional equivalent of what Belgium was doing, in the Congo. And because FDR, you know, it was a different moment in the U.S. in the trajectory of foreign policy, you know, so FDR was more open to having somebody like a radical like Gruning go down with Hull. And Gruning buttonholed Hull on the way down and basically said, you have to accept the right, you know, you have to give up the right of intervention and accept the absolute sovereignty of Latin American nations. That's the way to go. That's the thing. And Hull is like, no, how the hurry, you know, Hull is like, you know, what am I going to, you know, the Hearst papers will, you know, what are we going to do when Latin American revolutions break out and, you know, they start burning and marauding? And then Gruning said that usually happens after we intervene, you know, and Gruning was, and also in Hull's mind, there was a kind of analog relationship between free trade and non-interventionism. You know, he began to see that there was a political, you know, equivalence between laissez-faire economics and non-intervening in the political realm. And that's how he came to, when he showed up in Montevideo and Latin Americans made the demand, he said, okay, the United States recognizes the absolute sovereignty of all Latin American nations, no matter how big or small, in the internal and external affairs, you know, of all nations, and we reject the right to intervention. I mean, he was hailed as an unconquering hero. You know, the headline in the New York Times was "The Age of Imperialism is Over." Now, FDR sent Hull down there and told him not to make any commitments, to basically just give them some airplane, you know, airport landing lights so they can land their planes at night. And yet Hull did this radical turnaround that, you know, that changed the course of the New Deal. And it basically, it saved the New Deal and it set the United States up nicely to prepare for World War II and to fight fascism. The way it saved the New Deal is Hull comes back and he's able to convince Roosevelt to allow him to sign these non-reciprocal free trade agreements. You know, this was in early in the New Deal where the, you know, the left wing of the of FDR's brain trust was not very big on free trade, but Roosevelt saw the success in Latin America, and Hull within a short period of time signed something like 11 free trade agreements with Latin America. And what that did was that won back elites who had supported Roosevelt in 32, but broke with them, thinking, you know, broke with them over the NRA, broke with them over a number of things. And it consolidated a kind of high-tech, capital-intensive, corporatist bloc that wasn't as reactionary as the reactionaries that were backing things like the Liberty League and the fascists and, you know, like the DuPonts. And, you know, even though the DuPonts were chemicals and technically by their class interests, they should have supported open markets in Latin America. Anyway, but Hull becomes this agent of opening markets to the world. And that creates the kind of corporate ballast for the New Deal to move forward and consolidate itself, and for Roosevelt's reelection in 1936. The other thing that's fascinating, you know, we know the phrase good neighbor policy. You know, the United States has a good neighbor policy. It's become a little bit of a cliche. Under Roosevelt, it did have some content and meant recognizing the sovereignty of every nation. But it also became a domestic phrase. It was the Roosevelt set up all of these good neighbor leagues, or the people supported who ran Roosevelt's reelection campaign. And the Good Neighbor Leagues were consciously set up as an alternative to the Liberty Leagues, to the Saxon supremacy of the Liberty Leagues, the white supremacy of the Liberty Leagues. The Good Neighbor Leagues promoted cultural pluralism, right? So they organized blacks in the South and in Chicago and New York. They organized ethnic, you know, Catholics in, you know, in New York and Chicago. They organized Native Americans in the Southwest and Latinos in California. They became the venue in which a kind of new kind of social, you know, citizenship, tolerant, right? And there was an equivalence between Roosevelt's tolerance of Latin American nationalism. Roosevelt gave a speech after Hull's success. He says, "Your Americanism and mine." You know, it was a kind of an acceptance that Americanism didn't have to be, you know, the equivalent of Anglo-Saxon supremacy, that there was a kind of a tolerance and a pluralism. And through these good neighbor leagues, they promoted the same domestically. And you know, they were supported by business. Hull was able to use them to put forward his vision of free trade. So Roosevelt wins this election, you know, as the right is rising, as the Liberty Leagues are organizing, as, you know, as unionists are being killed and whatnot and beaten down in the streets of Detroit. Roosevelt wins the 1936 election with 27 million votes. You know, he won more votes than any other human being in the history of the world. And he did so on a kind of social liberal project. And the first thing that he does, you know, 2 weeks after winning the election, is he goes to Buenos Aires. He goes to Latin America. He does a tour of Latin America. And for me, that's, you know, that symbolizes how important, one, this vision of good neighborliness in creating a hemispheric, uniting foreign and domestic policy in this new kind of, a new kind of ideology, a new ethic, a new morality. And then also how Latin America becomes central in what comes next. I could keep going. You could say, what comes next?
Well, I think we actually have to jump ahead to the Cold War.
Really?
We can get to that. Yeah, sadly. It's, I mean, it would be wonderful. Pick up the book. Everybody needs to buy the book, and then they can read all this stuff.
But anyway, anti-fascism in Latin America. Latin Americans didn't. Well, let me just say quickly, Latin Americans didn't. They didn't think they were just fighting against fascism. They thought they were fighting for social democracy, and they understood what the New Deal as a corollary to the kind of the democratic socialism that was gaining ground. And the reason why Latin America didn't become Spain, which it could have, because it had all of the sociological variables that led to the rise of a Christian Praetorian nationalism, Catholic Praetorian nationalism in Spain. The worst case scenario of geopolitical strategists under FDR was that that would happen in all of Latin America, and then Latin America would be allied with the Axis. Was the reason that didn't happen is because FDR tilted to the left, and people like Henry Wallace and Rex Tugwell and the left wing of the New Deal that was involved in Latin America let economic nationalists know, you know, it's okay. You can you could take Rockefeller's oil fields in Mexico. You know, go ahead. You could take Hearst, you know, William Randolph Hearst's ranch. Go ahead. You know, and basically that's the reason Latin America didn't go fascist. One of the reasons. I'm giving you the abridged version. But the key takeaway is that they didn't think they were just fighting against fascism. They thought they were fighting for social democracy.
And yet, as it turns out.
But things turn out differently.
Yeah. So we get into the Cold War. World War II ends. We get into the Cold War. There is this surge of social democracy in Latin America that runs headlong into a United States that is turned on a dime from social democracy to anti-communism.
Yeah.
So talk about that abrupt shift and how it was received by folks in leaders in Latin America. You talk about, you know, for example, Salvador Allende in 1945 saying, thankfully, the United States of today is not the United States of yesterday. Yeah. At the same time that a Fidel Castro is taking a much different lesson from what he's seeing the United States do.
Yeah.
And particularly maybe we could talk a bit about the decision not to broaden the Marshall Plan out from Europe, to say we're going to reindustrialize Europe and prevent it from going communist by showering it with money, but Latin America is just going to remain in this subservient position. We're not going to do the same thing for that part of the world.
Yeah, I'll start with that. I mean, you know, Henry Wallace basically promised them a Marshall Plan. Henry Wallace did an enormously successful tour of Latin America in 1943. He was very involved in that as the chair of the Bureau of Economic Warfare, and he wrote into the procurement contracts of resources from Latin America labor clauses, which insisted on no racial discrimination, providing decent housing and a living wage. And he imagined these labor clauses as a kind of foundation for a kind of post-war social democratic order. And Wallace thought that Latin America had to industrialize and had to pay. His understanding of fascism, he said, we're going to beat fascism on the battlefield, but that's not where fascism thrives. Fascism thrives in places where people aren't paid a living wage. And his understanding was that we had to equalize the wage system of the, you know, to cover all of the world. And so Latin Americans fully expected a Marshall Plan. And that was one strut of the radicalization of the post-war generation when they didn't get it. The point of the Marshall Plan was that it would provide public capital to industries that wouldn't necessarily attract private capital because they, you know, they weren't profitable. Private capital went to the fields, they went to the mines. And if Europe was getting billions of dollars in free capital, there was going to be a greater demand for Latin American resources. So those industries would be more profitable, and Latin America wouldn't be able to create value-added industries unless it had something like the Marshall Plan, as Henry Wallace said it would. I mean, it wasn't called the Marshall Plan, but Wallace said the United States would be there. And of course, we know what happened to Henry Wallace after that tour of Latin America, in which he was hailed. Latin Americans didn't know that Roosevelt was going to run for a fourth term. They thought they were speaking to the president-elect effectively. They thought Henry Wallace was going to be was going to be elected president in 1944. So they were calling him Mr. President during that tour. And, you know, I make the argument in a book that that's one of the things that turned, you know, the Democratic Party against him. The last thing that they wanted was when they saw how popular Wallace was in Latin America and what he was promising them. In any case, not getting a Marshall Plan created the what we might call the structural dynamics for post-war Cold War polarization. You know, in Europe, because there's private capital, public capital through the Marshall Plan, you could allow anti-communist social democratic parties to build a welfare state, right? You didn't have to pacify the labor force in order to attract private capital in Europe. In Latin America, you know, the CIA, the State Department could talk all they want about wanting to work with an anti-communist democratic left. But the fact of the matter is, if elites were told, and they were explicitly told by none other than George Marshall himself when he went to Bogota in 1948, that there won't be a Marshall Plan and you have to attract private capital, you know, if you have unions in the street demanding greater wages, you have, you know, citizens demand an expansion of the welfare state, that's not exactly conducive to attracting private capital. So there was an incentive built in for elites to go after not just the communist left, but any kind of economic nationalist across the spectrum. And that's the foundational kind of structural dynamic that leads to waves of polarization, ever greater polarization, leading to the anti-communist states. Now, you asked about the generational difference between somebody like Salvador Allende and Fidel Castro. That's a good example. Allende, obviously, you know, he came around to seeing the United States as a threat, but at a slower pace than somebody who was young, like somebody like Castro, who was already eyeing, you know, what the United States was doing in Panama, or you know, they were more attuned to the turn. And the turn was on a dime in many ways. You know, it was 1947. The State Department issues a memo saying basically we are no longer understanding democracy and development as mutually constitutive. What's mutually constitutive is stability and development. And that is basically a green light. During World War II, the United States invested enormous repressive power in all of these states. You know, in Chile, for example, a state with the Allende, Chile elects a popular front government in 1946. You're running on, you know, standard stock of, you know, higher wages, social welfare, land reform. 1948, the miners go on strike. And the president turns on them, and he has at his disposal an enormous army, an enormous navy made possible by Latin America's land lend-lease program. And he basically unleashes a military occupation of the miner strikes in northern Chile. Northern Chile is put on lockdown, and the person leading that operation is none other than a young lieutenant named Augusto Pinochet. And using basically the repressive capacity given to Chile to fight fascism during World War II, against minors, you know, against domestic enemies. And that becomes a kind of that's a good kind of story that captures that gets played out in one country after another. And of course, as the Cold War develops, the United States invests more and more in the repressive capacity of Latin America in terms of its intelligence agency, in terms of its security forces, its ability to respond to domestic threats becomes much more quicker. And that hastens the polarization that I talked about earlier. And it gives rise to these anti-communist states. So that's the Cold War.
Again, it sounds like you would say it's a function of the Cold War, that the Cold War is this overriding logic that reshapes the United States' relationship to Latin America and at Latin America. Sorry, I said that so weird. And absent the Cold War, things would have been different.
Yes and no. I mean, Eric Hobsbawm says if the Soviet Union didn't exist, basically the post-World War settlement would have been varieties of authoritarian states in Europe. And, you know, I don't know, if the Soviet Union didn't exist, the United States probably would have let Latin American elites do what they wanted to do anyway, right? So I don't know. You know, certainly the Cold War provided a certain kind of logic and moral framework and the terms of justification and ability to fund. I mean, obviously the Cold War was determinant for many things. I mean, right, Truman embraces the Cold War as a way to have both guns and butter, right? You can have the New Deal at home and you can have, you know, this
military Keynesianism.
Take on these international commitments. And Truman,
if the Soviet Union did not exist, we would have to invent it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, right? What the United States would have supported. Certainly it would have, you know, certainly the United States' use of internationalism to induce domestic reform at home wouldn't have had the same power or capacity, I think. It's an interesting counterfactual.
So, Greg, I think we're going to have to make another big time jump and talk about where things stand today. You know, again, we urge people to buy the book and fill in all these blanks. But let's talk about the relationship between the United States and Latin America as it is in the post-Cold War, post-now unipolar moment with countries, some countries gravitating toward China, the United States trying to hang on to this region, not really through any positive reinforcement, as far as I can tell. But just sort of take us to the present day and, kind of how it reflects what you're talking about in your book.
Well, that's a big question. Latin America, as I've tried in this book and in Empire's Workshop, Latin America really is the place in which the U.S. rehearses certain, and obviously it's the place where, when, for a catch-all term, neoliberalism gets played out for the first time, and economic restructuring, and there's different ways of looking at it. You can look at the contemporary nature of what the U.S. was doing in Chile in 1975 and what the United States was doing in New York in 1975. And you can find of all of these connections. But Latin America really was the place in which, and there's not, you know, to understand neoliberalism, you really do have to understand Latin America. I first learned the word neoliberalism from Guatemalans. Latin America was the place where liberals like Porfirio Diaz are the archetypes of what neoliberals are of neos of, you know, the return of, right? The idea of a strong state that, you know, it's neoliberalism isn't the recession of the state or the dismantling of the state. It's the reorientation of the state to enforce certain economic policies, austerity, weakening labor laws, enforcement of debt. We know the whole, you know, ending tariffs, ending subsidies, and solidifying property rights. So all of that stuff takes place. You know, we know it's Chile, Argentina, Mexico, Latin America becomes the and then of course the lessons learned in Latin America then get applied to Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed. And the book looks at that circuit, right? How Latin America was in many ways the workshop for the economic restructuring of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. But then I also look at how the United States imposes a neoliberalism on itself. I mean, Bill Clinton comes to power in 1993, and you know, there's no enemy in sight. The United States is the wealthiest empire in world history, and Clinton begins to treat the United States as an occupied country and its citizens belligerent, right? He starts, you know, he focuses on terrorism, focuses on crime, focusing on immigration. It's, you know, many of the laws that Trump is now putting into place were first put on the books by Clinton, the ones that allow the denaturalization of people, you know, with naturalized citizens because they committed a crime. That's Clinton. And so, you know, other countries in the world, other wealthy countries had to restructure because of changes in the post-war global economy. 1970 was not the same as 1950s, right? There was the Third World had come online. There was competition from Japan. But no other country like the United States restructured the economy while simultaneously launching an assault on the institutions that could have buffered that restructure, and the destruction of unions, the dismantling of welfare, and the assault on rural communities through its agricultural policies. You know, this is what makes the United States unique. Not just every country, Germany and France and Great Britain, they all restructured. But the United States simultaneously launched an assault on all of the institutions that could have cushioned that restructuring. And I think that explains to a large degree how we wind up here now, and the creation of maybe 30% of the population that benefits from that economic globalization, and 70% of the population that doesn't benefit from it. But Latin America is key because also key is the influx of cheap labor from Latin America. I mean, really cheap labor, where middle class people can now have people cleaning their houses, you know, and, you know, that becomes a thing in the 1980s. The thing about Latin America, I mean, I'm a little bit all over the place because the book, you know, does come up to the present, is despite all of this, right, despite the violence of the Cold War, despite the depravity of neoliberalism and the hardships imposed by economic globalization and free trade, what's unique about Latin America, and this is the kind of takeaway from the book, is that it doesn't embrace, for the most part, the kind of toxic nationalism or anti-globalist conspiracism that we see in other countries, be it Russia, be it the United States, be it Turkey, be it the Philippines. Latin American nationalism still, to this day, is a stepping stone to internationalism. They understand nationalism is a building block to universalism, to a kind of humanism. That, you know, I've said this before, you know, but I'll say it again because it's a good way of, you know, social scientists have spent decades asking, you know, variations of one question: what accounts for the weakness of democracy in Latin America? But that question is exactly backwards. The real question is: what accounts for the endurance of democracy? What accounts for the endurance of a kind of social democratic ideal despite the violence? And this is a methodological strut of the book, the relationship of dehumanization and humanization, right? That, you know, the out of the Catholic Church, the world's greatest totalitarian organization, according to Sidney Hook, comes, you know, liberation theology. Out of Catholic colonialism comes social democracy. What's the relationship between the two? And it continues to this day. Latin America, inequality in Latin America is off the charts. More environmentalist activists are killed in Latin America every year than any other comparable region of the world. And yet environmentalists continue to fight more. You know, I'm sure you could probably this. I mean, I don't know the exactly, but trade unions, trans activists, feminists, they are assaulted and murdered and tortured at will. And yet these social movements continue to grow. The world's largest social movement is the LEMS, the landless movement in Brazil. It administers land that it has confiscated the size of Switzerland, you know, in a country that teeters back and forth between some cautious version of socialized democracy and Bolsonaro fascism. On the ground, these activists continue to believe that democracy means social democracy. And it's amazing. Even in countries like Guatemala, which, you know, you would think there'd be no hope whatsoever, people continue to fight and they continue to struggle. And you know, people say, well, there's Bukele in El Salvador, and there's the election in Ecuador that just passed. But it's amazing that that isn't, you know, it's amazing that Bukeleism isn't, you know, everywhere in Latin America, considering the corruption, considering the crime, considering the violence, most of which is an effect of U.S. policy, free trade policy, its drug policy, its migration policy. You know, the United States has spent the last three decades building out the infrastructure of neoliberalism and dispossession and extractivism in Latin America that accounts for the massive migration and displacement that has led to the crisis in the border and the rise of nativism in the United States. And yet still the left endures, and not just on a kind of measly way, but, you know, in some country, I mean, look at Mexico. Claudia Sheinbaum, I mean, if any country should embrace Bukeleism, it should be Mexico. I mean, the cartels, the corruption, the billionaires. And yet Morena, the party, first with AMLO and then with Claudia Sheinbaum, have managed to reclaim. I mean, they don't see themselves as going back to the Mexican Revolution. They call themselves the fourth transformation. It's the next step in the revolution. And, you know, there's limits and restraints on what they can do and whatnot. And, you know, you know, right now there's a teacher strike. I don't know what the resolution of that is, but Claudia Sheinbaum, a Jewish granddaughter of communist refugees, has 85% approval because and this is where I'll just end with this. You know, this is, I know you guys will agree with this. I think we're all on the same page. You know, you don't fight fascism by calling somebody a fascism. You don't fight ideology by saying you don't have ideology. You create ideology. If not, the right has been so effective at creating this conspiratorial world building. You know, we talked about Q before we started, QAnon. I mean, that's a kind of hegemony. I mean, it's a kind of world building that has filled the void of a social democratic ideology, and the right, and, you know, and if, and the left needs something to counter that. And an example of that is somebody like Sheinbaum in Mexico, 85% approval rate, and, you know, talking about, you know, not major radical reforms, but talking about the dignity of the working class, and, you know, despite all of, you know, there's lots to criticize, but, you know, it's a miracle. Mexico is a miracle. It really is when you think about it.
On that note, I think that's a good place to end. It's happier than most of the interviews, most of the ways we end our interviews around here. So, Greg, I want to thank you again for coming on the program. Folks, the book is America, A New History of the New World. Pick it up. It's absolutely a tour de force. Wonderful book. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks so much, Derek. Thanks so much, Danny.